This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio.
When it started, a girl's wedding and New Year's Eve were only 6 hours away, and I didn't think the bride-to-be would make either one of them. But that was before I ran up against the slot machine operator, the escaped convict, and above all, the old acquaintance.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. And now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, The Old Acquaintance.
At 6 o'clock in the last evening of the year, I was sitting with my feet up on my office desk thinking of impossible New Year's resolutions and what the girl on my butcher's 1949 calendar would or would not be wearing. But at that pleasant point, there was a soft, almost apologetic knock on my office door. I said, come in, and saw a quiet man in quiet clothes who extended a quiet hand. He introduced himself as Paul Riker, a Beverly Hills insurance broker. But the tremor in his voice said, very worried client, which on New Year's Eve was something I could do without.
Mr. Marlowe, you've got to find Nancy Marshall for me.
Just for a springboard, Mr. Riker, who is Nancy Marshall?
She's my fiancée. We were to be married at my place in Beverly Hills tonight.
On New Year's Eve?
Yes, you see, it was at a New Year's Eve party a year ago that we met for the first time.
Oh, when'd you last hear from her?
2 hours ago. She called and said that she was in terrible trouble, that nobody, especially the police, could help her, that the wedding was off.
I see. You're sure it's not just a matter of your being left at the altar, huh?
Another man. Oh, no, I'm certain that's not it. Now, please, Mr. Marlowe, will you help me?
Mr. Riker, to you, New Year's Eve means wedding bells, but to me, it's something else, specifically a cozy little apartment on Wilshire Boulevard where there's a very nice girl and a couple of chilled bottles of sham.
Oh, what is it, Mr. Marlowe?
Shh,
what's wrong?
There's somebody outside, Riker. Get away from that door, quick! Whoever threw those shots through the frosted glass in my office door wasn't interested in checking up on his marksmanship. Because by the time I got to my feet, he was taking the stairs to the street. When I got outside, I was just in time to see him pile into a pickup truck and roar off. And the best I could do was get a face full of exhaust fumes and the last three numbers on his license plate, which read 711. When I got back to Riker in the glass on my office floor, I found the potential groom whiter, shakier, and less quiet than at our first meeting.
Marlowe, did you get him? Do you know who it was?
No, I don't. Now relax a minute, Riker, and think.
Yes.
Who could possibly object to you and Nancy getting married?
But that's just it. There's nobody I know of, Mr. Marlowe, and I'm positive that the same is true of Nancy.
All right, now tell me, where does Nancy live?
In a villa at 1428 North Havenhurst Drive, number 12.
Mm-hmm.
But I've already been there, and she's gone.
Were you inside?
No, the door was locked. But, Mr. Marlowe, I thought you had specific plans for this evening.
I do. But from the way things stack up right now, they've got a better chance of keeping than Nancy Marshall. Now, look, go back to your place in Beverly Hills, stay away from frosted glass windows, and wait till you hear from me. We're real lucky, Mr. Riker. It still might turn out to be a happy New Year. When Riker left the office, I called Lieutenant Ibarra at police headquarters. After being told that it would take at least a half hour to get my kind of lead out of the 7-Eleven I had on the pickup truck's license, I headed for Nancy's villa on North Havenhurst, where it took me 10 minutes to outsmart the catch on the back door. Inside, except for a carelessly overturned box of old snapshots, which meant nothing to me, and a lot of half-open drawers and closets, I was no place. And in the kitchen, where there was a full cup of cold coffee next to an open newspaper, the setup was almost the same. But not quite. Because on the front page of the paper, there was a banner story complete with pictures that shouted the news of three men who had broken out of the state penitentiary that morning. And one of them, a man named Steve Doyle, had a face that I'd seen only minutes ago on one of the snapshots in the overturned box. I grabbed the paper and started back to check with the snapshot once again for good measure. But the second I stepped into the living room, I stopped.
Hello. I don't believe I know you.
Oh, the voice matched the lady perfectly. She was tall, beautiful brunette, about 30, wearing a beige metallic wool jersey that covered more curves than a ride on a roller coaster. But the large monogrammed A on her purse meant that this was not the woman who had planned to marry Paul Riker.
I said I don't believe I know you.
The name is Arthur Murray. You're late for your rumble lesson.
Oh, never mind the jokes, bright boy. It's a waste of your time and mine.
All right, then we'll play it very straight. Name is Philip Marlowe. I'm a private detective, and I'm working for a very worried man. Now you, what's your connection with Nancy Marshall?
I'm just, shall we say, an old acquaintance, that's all.
Not enough. I'll prime the pump some more. I was hired to find Nancy, who seems to be in a lot of trouble. And coincidentally in trouble on the same day that Steve Doyle breaks out of stir. Now, once more, exactly where do you fit in?
I don't think I'll tell you, Mr. Marlowe. If you don't mind.
Well, pearl handled, huh? How very chic.
But deadly. Now get in that closet there, Marlowe. Go on.
All right. But just so we don't go through this same routine when we meet again, and we will, who are you?
You don't listen very carefully, Marlowe. I've already told you that I'm an old acquaintance. It's the season for them, remember? Now get in there and shut up.
Nancy Marshall's villa was post-war construction at its worst, closets included. So I didn't stay tucked away with the mothballs any longer than it takes to say old acquaintance. And the minute I'd kicked my way out, I went right for the telephone and my only 100% bona fide lead, the number 711.
This is Lieutenant Ibarra.
Marlowe, Ibarra. Anything for me on that license number?
Oh, yeah. If you're sure it was a pickup truck, the chances are pretty good that it either belongs to a party named Maurice J. Calder at 409 South Main, or one Jerome Graff, 3221 and a half Melrose Avenue.
Check.
What's up, Phil? Anything I might be interested in?
It depends. Ever hear of a guy named Steve Doyle?
One of that gang that broke out this morning?
The very same. Matter of fact, he's probably driving that pickup truck right now.
Oh.
But look, Ibarra. I think I know what I'm doing, so how about letting me run this end of it until I get stuck?
Well,
there's a girl named Nancy Marshall mixed up in this, and a delay at this time might cost her life.
All right, I'll stay clear, Phil, for a while.
Good.
But just so you don't get too careless, remember, Doyle got out of jail this morning the hard way. He killed two guards.
Oh, fine.
Goodbye, Marlowe.
I got the 409 South Main. I knew that my first choice had to be wrong, because Maurice J. Calder turned out to be a bankrupt junkman, and his pickup truck, which was loaded with everything including the kitchen sink, had three flat tires and hadn't moved in a week. So if the numeral 711 were going to live up to their reputation, Jerome Graff had to be my man. And that made the time to be careful now. .3221½ Melrose was a tired cottage set back about 50 weed-covered feet from the sidewalk. And from the rusted sign, Jerry Graff, mechanic, dangling at a crazy angle from a weather-beaten beam over the front door, I gathered that the place doubled as both Mr. Graff's living quarters and shop. And I didn't see any truck out front, so I decided to try the alley in the rear before I knocked on any door. It was then that I noticed for the first time that I was being watched by a short man with a long face, who was slouched against a nearby tree like a marionette with no strings attached.
If you're lost, mister, maybe I can help you.
Maybe. I was looking for a pickup truck. Seen one around?
A pickup truck?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Now, I wonder what that could be.
Well, it's a small deal, about a half a ton and... Oh, I get it. Okay, here. Here's five. Now my question.
Jerry Graff owns a pickup truck, but it ain't here. It's been out since dark. But Jerry's in. He's working late tonight.
Working at what? Come on, you got your five. Talk.
Okay. It ain't no secret. Jerry's a nursemaid for one-armed bandits.
Slot machines, huh? Is that his racket?
Yeah. He used to be a big boy with them, too. But times have changed. Now he just works on them for other guys.
What other guys?
Oh, mister, I wouldn't answer that for even another five. I wouldn't stay in business very long if I did. But I'll tell you one thing for free in case you're going to visit Jerry.
What's that?
Watch out for him. He's a very nasty man.
Thanks, but I can take care of myself, Buster.
What do you want?
Information. Where's your pickup truck, Graff?
Somebody stole it, but he didn't leave his card. Why, what are you, a private dick?
That's right, but one that works close to the law. So why don't we call the boys in blue and tell them all about it?
The cops? No, and wait a minute. I don't like the law pattern around here. Come on in, I'll tell you what you want to know.
Let's not skip any of the details, huh? Like, for example, the name Steve Doyle?
Doyle? I don't know. Well, okay, fella, you win. The story goes something like this.
Want to try again?
Maybe a monkey wrench will convince you.
You don't throw any straight in your talk, Pat. Come on. What do you say? Do we play some more? Come on, talk. Come on. Come on.
Wait a minute. I'll talk.
All right.
I've had enough.
So far, I know a girl named Nancy Marshall's in some kind of trouble because Steve Doyle broke out of the pen this morning. Now, you fill in the blanks.
Oh, sure, sure. Why not? Oh, Steve Doyle, he used to be crazy about Nancy, but she didn't go for him. Then about a year ago, a little more maybe, Steve got picked up for knocking over a grocery store. He figured he was caught because Nancy tipped the law to get him out of her hair.
Now he's out to get Nancy for revenge, is that it?
Yeah, that's it. And anyone who's close to her gets the same treatment.
Oh, chummy. Now tell me, was Doyle here? Is he the one who's driving your pickup truck?
Yeah, but it wasn't my idea. He shoved a gun in my face, said we were old friends, and asked for the keys.
You know where he is now?
No, but if I did, I'd keep it to myself. Doyle's full of hate, brother. You can count on that. Now, what do you say about clearing out of here?
Just as soon as I find out one more thing. Now, there's another girl mixed up in this. She's a brunette with a lot of curves and the initial A. Calls herself an old acquaintance of Nancy's. Any idea who she is?
No, not the slightest.
You're a liar, Graff, and if I had time, I'd beat the truth out of you.
No, you haven't, believe me, because if you don't hustle, mister, when you do catch up with Nancy Marshall, you're going to catch up with a corpse. Nothing more.
When I got outside, two things stood out in my mind like a pair of cleats at Carnegie Hall. First, my client's fiancé was not the most innocent dame in greater Los Angeles. And second, I wasn't going to get any place until I could locate the old acquaintance. But then, just as I started for my car, the slouch who had sold me the dirty thumbnail sketch on Jerry Graff came running toward me.
Hey, mister! Did everything work out all right? I was called away on some other business, or I'd have been here waiting.
Waiting for what?
Well, you know, in my game, I now and again give a guy a little more dope than he bargained for, and in that case, I sometimes end up with a bonus, so to speak.
Well, right now, we're about even. But if you can tell me anything about a beautiful brunette whose first name starts with an A, I'll give you a bonus that'll keep you in beer and pretzels from now until the 4th of July.
Name that begins with an A?
Yeah.
Hey, she visited with Graff this morning, maybe?
Yeah, it's possible. Come on, think hard.
She's kind of tall, dresses like $1 million.
That's right. Now, what's her name? Here, look. $20 bill.
Mm.
A name, what is it?
It's, I got it. Adrian Starr, 1312 Lookout Mountain Road.
How do you know that?
It was on the registration card in her car. I took a peek. Why'd she... Trouble. At Graff's. I'll take my 20. Goodbye.
I beat it up the walk to Graff's, and when I got inside, I found exactly what I expected. Doubled up on the floor in the middle of a lot of oily machine parts and still holding his stomach with both hands was Jerome Graff, a very dead man. I started for a telephone to call Lieutenant Ibarra, but then I noticed something small and gold lying a few feet away from the body. When I picked it up, I saw it was an ornamental buckle, the kind that a lady might wear on a coat. So I decided to skip Lieutenant Ibarra for the time being and call my client instead.
Hello?
This is Marlowe, Riker.
Oh, yes, Marlowe. What is it? What have you found out?
Quite a bit. But first, I've got to know one thing. Does Nancy Marshall have a gold belt buckle?
A gold belt buckle?
Yeah.
Why, yes, she does on her black coat. But what about it, Marlowe? What does it mean?
I'm not sure, Mr. Riker. But it may mean that Nancy Marshall just killed a man.
In just a moment, we will return to the second act of The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. But first, by this time, a week from tonight, Jack Benny will have made his first broadcast exclusively on the CBS network. Starting next Sunday, you'll find Jack here with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, Don Wilson, and all the others who have made the Jack Benny Show a regular Sunday evening delight for millions of Americans. Just for fun, the Jack Benny kind of fun, make a New Year's resolution to hear the Jack Benny Show every Sunday starting a week from tonight January 2nd, over these same CBS network stations. And now, with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Old Acquaintance.
When I told Paul Riker that the chances were good that his bride-to-be had just knocked off a slot machine operator, my client reacted like I'd kicked him in the stomach. When he caught his breath again, he started telling me I was wrong and didn't stop until I hung up on him. Next thing on the agenda was that call to Lieutenant Ibarra.
Lieutenant Ibarra speaking.
Marlowe again, Lieutenant.
Oh, did you find the owner of that pickup truck, Phil?
Yeah, I found him, Ibarra. I'm calling from his shop now. I had a talk with the guy. It was Jerry Graff.
What do you mean, was Jerry Graff?
Well, somebody came in here and shot him just after I left. He's dead.
Dead?
He knew Steve Doyle all right, but I'm pretty sure Doyle didn't kill him, Ibarra.
No? Then who did? Any idea, Marlowe?
Well, looks very much like my client's fiancée, Nancy Marshall. Uh-huh. I still don't know where she is or how it all fits together, but look, I got a lead on an old acquaintance of Nancy's named Adrian Starr. She lives up on Lookout Mountain Road.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't hear from me in, say, an hour, you might check. Number 1312, that's my next stop.
Okay, just be sure it's not your last stop. Goodbye.
I drove up Laurel Canyon to Lookout Mountain. The only sign of life was a young couple parked where they could look down at the city lights, if they wanted to. I backed into a bushy driveway across from Adrian Starr's bungalow and stopped. It was small, modern, and looked deserted. Except for one dim light upstairs. I was about to get out and verify that when a pair of headlights flashed down the road and a yellow convertible swept to a halt in front of the place. It was Adrian Starr who got out. She started up the walk toward her front door, stopped suddenly, and then ran back to her car and drove off again. I kept the yellow convertible in sight. When it turned on Havenhurst and stopped in front of Nancy Marshall's villa, I pulled up in time to see Adrian step inside and close the door. So I followed her.
Marlowe, what do you want?
I want to know what Jerry Graff means to you, Adrian.
I don't know any Jerry Graff, so it means nothing.
Come on, stop it. You went down to his shop to see him this morning. I thought you might like to know that he's dead.
Dead?
Mm-hmm. The cops are hungry for anybody who so much as knew his name. Maybe I better come inside and talk it over, don't you think?
Yeah, maybe you better. Just a minute.
Thanks. Hey, it's dark. Why don't you turn on more lights?
Because I like it this way.
Okay. But, honey, if you've still got that pearl-handled popcorn of yours, let's leave it out of the conversation. And let's make it straight. Why'd you drop in on Graff this morning?
Because I knew that sooner or later Steve Doyle would head there. I had to know if Steve intended to leave town or was still determined to get his crazy revenge.
And all for Nancy Marshall, huh? You know, you're sticking your neck out quite a ways just for old time's sake, baby. Steve Doyle's a pretty tricky guy to mix with at this point.
You can say that again, Phil.
Steve! Oh, Steve.
Steve Doyle.
That's right. Who are you, mister?
Marlowe, private detective.
Sit down over there, private detective. Keep your hands out of your pockets. I don't like you because you're half cop, but play it smart and you won't get hurt. Well, Adrian, like old home week, huh?
Oh, it's been a long time, Steve.
Yeah, it sure has. Where is she, Adrian? Where's Nancy?
I don't know, Steve.
You're lying to me. This is her place. You got in with a key. You've been down to see Graff. You know where she is, all right. So tell me and tell me fast.
Oh, Steve, listen, forget it. Forget about Nancy. This revenge will only get you in the gas chamber. Please, let's get away. We can still make it across the border. Please take me with you. I love you, Steve, just like I always have, even when you threw me over for Nancy.
Shut up, shut up. Just tell me where Nancy is. Come on, Adrian.
I don't know, Steve.
Stop it, Doyle.
Where is she?
Steve, you're hurting me.
Doyle.
Don't move, Marlowe. All right, fella, I told you to behave. I've been through a lot, and I'm tired, and I'm running out of time. You're getting in my hair, and that's bad.
Oh, no, Steve, oh, don't!
I won't shoot him. I can't afford the noise. I can give him something just as good. Oh. Now, Adrian, try again. Where's Nancy?
I don't know, Steve.
Come on, where is she?
I don't know.
Where's Nancy?
I don't know.
Where's Nancy?
I couldn't remember where I was. know how long I've been lying there, but gradually I got the crazy idea that I was being robbed by a very unhappy crook. Because I was sure that somebody was crying and going through my pockets at the same time. Oh, I tried to open my eyes. But all I could see was a little gold buckle dance back and forth in front of me. When it finally disappeared altogether, I rolled over and hauled myself up onto my knees. And then it all came rushing back to me. I'd been in Nancy Marshall's villa with Steve Doyle and Adrian Starr. Only they were gone now, and I was alone. I heard a car start outside, so I got on my feet and made it along the wall to the door. It was Adrian, and she was behind the wheel of my coupe.
Stay away from me, Marlowe.
Where's Doyle?
He took my car. He's gone up to Nancy. I've got to stop him, Marlowe, so get out of the way.
Somehow I managed to jump back just in time to keep from getting a press job with the tread of my own fist tires. And it took 10 minutes of steady concentration to get it through my throbbing head that Adrian had actually stolen my car and was gone. Oh, the cold air must have helped me, because one thought led to another, and I finally began to separate the facts from the fancies. I hadn't dreamed all I thought I had. And when I realized that, the whole idea hit me, and hit me hard. I knew that I'd better get out to Lookout Mountain in a hurry. I made it to Sunset, hailed a cab, and collapsed in it.
Where to, mister?
Lookout Mountain Road. Make it fast.
Oh, it's rugged in this truck. Who you see, you know?
Here's $10. Does that help? It's important.
Oh, it helps plenty. I know a great shortcut, a new road that's not yet finished. But how are you on bumps?
A few more won't matter, pal. Let's go. When it was over, I felt like I'd crossed the country on a pogo stick. But the cab driver was a genius, and with a shortcut, we made the distance to Lookout Mountain in less than 10 minutes. When we got near the place, I sent the cab back down the hill out of danger, and went the rest of the way on foot. As I got within sight of Adrian's bungalow, I saw Steve Doyle getting out of the yellow convertible. I ran up to the house, tried the door. It was locked.
Nancy, where are you? I know you're in there, baby. I'm going to find you. I have to take this joint apart. We've got some old business to settle, remember?
So have we, Doyle. What? Drop that gun. Stand still.
Okay, sucker.
You won't need that gun anymore, Doyle. Just kick it over there out of the way.
Someday I'll get you for this fella.
I doubt it, Steve. You're all finished, but you're too thick-headed to see it. Well, I guess it's time to relax and wait for Adrian. And we call the cops,
Adrian, huh? Adrian just arrived, Marlowe. Don't what? Turn around or I'll kill you.
Adrian.
There we are, Marlowe. Toss your gun back here to me. Come on now. It's better. Oh, Steve. Steve, are you hurt bad? Darling, can you make it to the car?
I'll try, Adrian. Got me on this side. It's bad.
Oh, Steve, hurry, darling, hurry. I'll be with you in a minute.
I'll make it okay.
Well, Marlowe?
Yeah.
Okay, Adrian.
Tell me one thing first, Marlowe. Did Steve get to Nancy?
No. You killed Graff in time to shut him up, too, huh? So Steve will never know the truth, will he, Adrian? Could be it was you who crossed him and sent him to prison.
You'll never find out. Not now. And you'll never realize how much I love him, either. That's why I did it, Marlowe. It was the only way I could hold him for myself. And I was willing to wait. Can you understand that?
Yeah. I guess I can. Too bad a love like yours has to be wasted on a guy like Steve. You'll never get away, honey. Not with him. You'll never make it.
Maybe not. But if he goes out, at least I'll be with him, Marlowe, and that's the way I want it.
Well, if you're going to do anything, Adrian, you better get it over with fast. That siren's a friend of mine. He's coming here.
Adrian!
Coming, Steve. You're a good guy, Marlowe, and a smart one. Just don't follow us, that's all. So long, Marlowe. Happy New Year.
Call just pull out of here. Who was in it?
Steve Doyle and Adrian Starr, Ibarra.
That road makes a horseshoe turn. That'll bring them out down below us there, that junction. I've got one of those streets blocked, but the other one's wide open.
Look, Ibarra, there they are. She's stopping at the crossroad.
Yeah, they've spotted my men down there. She's turning around. They're heading out the other way. She must be crazy, Marlowe. They'll never make that curve at that speed.
They're not slowing down, Ibarra. She's heading straight for that stone wall.
Well, Speed, that's it. It's all over. They're both dead when the boys got to them. Killed instantly. By the way, how's your head feel now? Any better?
I'm okay, Byron.
Did you take care of Nancy Marshall all right?
Yeah, she locked herself upstairs. Sent her home to Paul Riker in the squad car. The driver hurries. They can still be married on New Year's Eve.
You had a pegged as Jerry Graff's killer earlier tonight, Marlowe. What made you change your mind?
Well, I found a gold buckle near Graff's body, Bar. I figured it was a fancy little belt buckle that Nancy had dropped. But I saw exactly the same buckle when I was coming to after Doyle hit me on the head. And it wasn't on a belt, it was on a shoe. Adrian's shoe. It was the mate of the one I'd found.
Once you know Adrian Starr killed Graff, you put the rest of it together, is that it?
Uh-huh. See, for a price, Graff helped Adrian double-cross Steve. She had to kill him to keep him from talking. She hid Nancy out for the same reason. If she knew that if Steve ever got to Nancy, he'd learn the truth.
I wonder why she didn't kill Nancy, too.
I think she intended to, Ibarra.
And she did it all, really, because she loved the guy too much. Strange deal, Marlo, right to the end. You know, she didn't have a chance to make that curve down there the way she was driving.
Not even if she wanted to make it, Ibarra.
Yeah. Well, it's 5 minutes to midnight, Phil. Happy New Year, fella. I want to see a lot of you in 1949.
Same to you, Lieutenant. Good night. After Ibarra and the others left, I stayed up on Lookout Mountain and watched the new year come to Los Angeles. A new year. Didn't seem to change things much, at least on the surface. Somewhere down the road, a gang struck up Auld Lang Syne. I thought again of Adrian Starr, a girl who loved not wisely, who had called herself an old acquaintance. Yeah, I'd never forget her. As I walked back to my car, the city was ringing out the old and ringing in the new. And I wished then that someplace on everybody's list of resolutions, they'd make room for that cup of kindness they were singing about. And then a guy could say, Happy New Year, and mean it.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, stars Gerald Moore and is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Script is by Mel Donnelly, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Gloria Blondell, Edgar Berrier, David Ellis, Lou Krugman, and Stan Waxman. Lieutenant Ibarra was played by Jeff Corey. The special music was by Richard Arant. Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
They all knew he was aboard the yacht when it exploded and sank. And everybody called his death an accident. Yeah, that is everybody except the corpse himself. He said it was murder.
An hour of wonderful, delirious comedy is still to come to you tonight on CBS. You'll soon hear Hollywood's Eve Arden starring as the unusual schoolmistress, our Miss Brooks. Later, Lum and Abner will open the doors of the Jot 'em Down store in Pine Ridge, Arkansas, and let you stock up on the last from their never-failing supply of wisdom and good humor. Our Miss Brooks, starring Eve Arden, is heard at 9:30, and Lum and Abner at 10 o'clock, both Eastern Standard Time, over most of these same CBS network stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
From New York City, the makers of Clipper Craft Clothes for Men and more than 1,200 leading retail stores from coast to coast present Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's immortal character, the world's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes, starring John Stanley. Thank you. this week's story, The Guest in the Coffin.
Well, where's the funeral coach, Holmes? Downstairs. You see it?
Yes, Watson. Come quickly. We must run down the stairs to meet them.
I have my revolver ready, Holmes.
Put it away, Watson. We shan't have need of it. Just yet.
Yes, but they said when the funeral cortege comes, they'd kill you. I can't protect you if I put it away, you know?
My dear Watson, the effort to kill me will not be as obvious as you think. No, it will be completely unexpected and as shocking a spectacle as you've ever witnessed.
Men, this is the time of year when our wives are planning their new spring wardrobes, so I don't think I'm out of order when I ask you, isn't it time you bought a new spring suit, too? You don't have to spend a fortune. A genuine Clippercraft worsted suit costs only $45. But don't let that low price fool you. Clippercraft suits look like they cost many, many dollars more. Clippercraft suits have style you'd never expect to buy for $45. In a Clippercraft suit, you look your best. Your shoulders appear broader, your hips seem to taper down. You look and feel like you're somebody, somebody important. And you are. You're the best-dressed man in any group. So, go pick out a Clippercraft suit for yourself. And while you're about it, get a Clippercraft top coat, too, for only $40 to $47.50. Clippercraft clothes do things for you. Visit your local Clippercraft merchant tomorrow. Dr. Watson, what do you mean by a guest in the coffin? And to what sort of gruesome business would such a guest be invited?
It was in the late 80s, Mr. Harris. It began at Charing Cross Station. There on the platform stood a short, red-faced, chubby gentleman in a black bowler hat. He looked about rather helplessly. Then he beckoned to a police officer.
Constable. Constable.
Yes, sir. May I be of assistance?
I just arrived here in London and I'm rather confused. Could you direct me to Earl's Court?
Certainly, sir. Just a few stops on the Inner Circle Underground. Entrance to the Underground, just your left, sir.
And that will take me there?
Right you are, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very grateful.
Not at all, sir.
You must allow me to show my appreciation.
Sorry, sir, we do not accept a gratuity.
Oh, but, officer, this is a special award. You see, I've selected you.
Selected me?
Yes. You shall be the first of the London police to die.
The poor constable was pushed before the passing train, and his body was crushed. The chubby little gentleman in the black bowler hat vanished instantly into the panic-stricken crowd. This was the first step in a monstrous scheme. The second step was executed in Soho. It was very late in the evening. A bobby on a tour of duty was strolling past a dark alley when he heard a pitiable voice.
Help me. Help me.
Hello in there. Someone in this alley?
Yes. Help me.
What's wrong, sir?
I'm very ill. I collapsed here. I can't breathe. My lungs.
Yes, sir, I'll help you. A bit of artificial respiration, then I'll fetch an ambulance. I'll just... You knocked my helmet off. I'll just take you in my arms, so... One moment, I must put my nightstick aside.
Thank you. All I wanted was your club. We thought it would be amusing for a police officer to be clubbed to death with his own club.
Be seated, Lestrade. Pacing the floor of my flat in that nervous manner is not conducive to clear thinking.
You may choose to regard this crisis, Holmes, as a bagatelle, a trinket to be toyed with in your mind, but I find it most upsetting.
Inspector Lestrade, how many police have died?
7, Dr. Watson. The officer clubbed to death in Soho was followed by 5 more in various parts of London. You've read the newspapers, Holmes. You're conscious of the terrible fear gripping London. And the morale of the force is at an absolute low.
That is to be expected, Lestrade.
The force is human, Holmes. The men leave for duty in a state of high tension. This series of police murders may lead to an unprecedented crime wave. It's a signal to the scum of the London underworld to storm the very fortress of law itself.
Lestrade, could you abandon the oratory long enough to tell me if there are any clues as to the identity of this Bobby killer?
None. None whatsoever. Not that we at Scotland Yard are utterly helpless, mind you. But we are obliged to marshal every resource at our command. That's why we are requesting that you lend us the benefits of your incomparable skill as a detective.
Well, Lestrade, your ineptitude as a criminologist is equaled only by your clumsiness as a diplomat. However, I shall look into these reports you've given to me.
They are official copies, Holmes. Reports on the death of each policeman. After reading them, if you've a suggestion...
I shall communicate with you, yes.
It's a horrible business, horrible. Eh, Holmes?
Oh, on the contrary, considering some police officers I know, rather tempting.
Good night, gentlemen.
You are going to help, aren't you, Holmes?
Yes, after reading and analyzing these reports, Watson, I shall take what steps I deem proper. I should say that the most vital point so far is the scope of these crimes. This is not the single discordant note struck by a petty crook. This is a broad, elaborately orchestrated scheme, worthy of a certain very daring type of mind.
I'll answer it, Holmes.
Good evening, Dr. Watson. Mr. Holmes?
Although you apparently recognize us, sir, I do not believe we may return the favor.
My name is Jenkins. Hubert Jenkins.
Is the purpose of your visit connected with the fact that you're a mortician?
How did you surmise that,
sir? Although you are quite short and are wearing a black bowler hat, you stooped as you entered. The doorway is easily high enough. You are, therefore, in the habit of wearing an extremely high hat, the long black hat typical of your profession. Besides, your hands are stained by an acid, arsenic probably, arsenical compounds being used in the preparation of embalming fluid.
Oh, that's amazing, Holmes.
The purpose of my visit is definitely connected with my profession, and I do bury the dead.
What may we do for you, Mr. Dagan?
I have a message for you, Mr. Holmes, from my employer.
Who is your employer?
The gentleman, with admirable humility, wishes to remain anonymous. He wishes to present you, Mr. Holmes, with a gift as an unknown admirer of yours. Really, the finest way to present a gift.
And what is the gift?
A coffin, sir. A coffin.
A coffin?
And to be sure that the offer is accepted in the right spirit and that I'm not forced to go beyond this simple information, I was obliged to bring a gun.
I appreciate your master's thoughtfulness, but I don't believe I can be his guest in the coffin.
Oh, we shall attend to that little detail.
Are you threatening to kill Holmes?
Not threatening, Dr. Watson. Simply announcing a fact. By Friday midnight, Mr. Holmes, there will be need of a coffin for you.
Who sent you? Where are you from? By George, you will answer me.
Now, Dr. Watson, that is why I brought the gun. I do not want to answer any more questions. Mr. Holmes, my master is most anxious for you to be pleased. Do you have a preference as to the type of coffin you wish?
Of all the grotesque, infuriating...
Almost any sort of coffin should do, Jenkins.
I shall select one of our very attractive models, Mr. Holmes. You may depend on it. It will be in superbly discriminating taste. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'd wind up my affairs if I were you, Mr. Holmes. You've so short a time.
I believe I can spend the remaining days quite profitably, Jenkins.
No doubt, sir. No doubt. Delightful visit, gentlemen. Good evening.
Well, Holmes, what shall we do? Who was he? Who sent him? Why should they want to kill you, Holmes?
We shall do very little, Watson. We shall inform Inspector Lestrade of this extraordinary visit.
Yes, and I'd say we search London for this Jenkins the mortician.
That would be futile. Jenkins is definitely not his correct name. It might take weeks to find him, and we have just a few days. No, we shall merely chat with Lestrade and then wait for Friday midnight.
You mean just wait till they come to kill you, Holmes? That's ridiculous. I'd turn London upside down to find that rascal. Then I'd beat him till he told us the name and whereabouts of his employer.
Oh, impossible to accomplish by Friday, Watson. Besides, why bother? Jenkins promised to return here to Baker Street. He must deliver the exquisite coffin he's selecting.
Well, tell me, Holmes, did you learn anything from Jenkins' visit? Is there a clue as to who on earth is behind all this?
Definitely. My imminent death and the death of a long line of London police are obviously connected.
How?
Both crimes are engineered by the same mind, Watson. No pedestrian mind could conceive of staging this macabre business. Your ordinary criminal would go after me with a knife, and that would be that. No, this is a mind with a more fiendish approach. They want me to suffer mentally before I do physically.
And you propose sitting idly by and waiting until Friday night?
Quite. Oh, I shall make some preparation for the combat, some polishing of a harpoon. Then what remains to be seen is whether, as in the pursuit of Moby Dick, we capture the awful monster, or it devours us.
Well, it's 5 minutes before 12.
Yes, indeed, Watson. I do hope my would-be killer is a gentleman of his word. I can excuse the attempt to murder me, but being late for the game is unforgivable.
Oh, really? I don't see how you can be so utterly carefree, Holmes, when you know that a diabolical mind is plotting to kill you within the next 5 minutes. Good Lord, what have you been overconfident, Holmes? And why the devil wouldn't you permit Lestrade to place a cordon of police about this house?
Because, Watson, anyone shrewd enough to have killed all those bobbies and to have flung the gauntlet in my face this way has certainly anticipated a cordon. Besides, with policemen striding about, they might be in the way. We might bungle the capture of the killer. No, I prefer meeting my antagonist single-handed.
4 minutes to 12 now.
Aha, excellent. The killers are on time. The window, Watson, see.
Yes. Yes, on the street is the funeral coach. It's pulling up here, at our door.
We must go down to greet them, Watson.
Go down to greet them, Holmes? Have you lost your mind? Do you want to place yourself as a perfect target on the street for the gaslight? I'm for bolting the door and standing them up.
Oh, nonsense, Watson. I want to meet them face to face.
It's Jenkins, the mortician. He's driving the funeral coach. He has a helper riding beside it.
Come, Watson, quickly, down the stairs into the street.
They shoot you as you appear the very minute you're on the street.
Oh, not at all, Watson. The effort to kill me will not be as blunt and obvious as that. No, it'll be unexpected and as shocking a spectacle as you've ever witnessed.
Then you know what they'll try to do.
If I'm incorrect, we may only hope the coffin they've brought for me is the correct size and in good taste, since I shall have need of it. Here we are on the street.
Well, here's the funeral coach. There's Jenkins.
Good evening, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Watson.
Good evening, Jenkins.
Oops, steady. Fine horses, don't you think?
Splendid.
We like everything about our funerals to be most impressive. There's your coffin, Mr. Holmes. One of our very best.
Considerate of you.
My master said my helper and I should carry the coffin to your flat.
Don't you move, Jenkins. Your helper either. Holmes will be very much alive at 12 o'clock, if I have anything to say about it.
Oh, we aren't going to touch Mr. Holmes until he's dead, that is. A special way's been arranged for him to die. We've nothing to do with that part of it. It's a plan that begins at 12. There. Yes. Now you will see, gentlemen. Now you will see.
Unless you're already familiar with Clippercraft clothes, you might find it hard to believe that Clippercraft worsted suits cost only $45 and Clippercraft topcoats cost only $40 to $47.50 because they look like they cost much more. There's a good solid reason for this. Clippercraft clothes are sold by over 1,200 independent local merchants who have pooled their tremendous buying power to make these amazing Clippercraft values possible. In Clippercraft clothes, you get workmanship in the finest New England tradition, quality workmanship, and quality materials worthy of the famous Yankee Clipper ships from which Clippercraft clothes take their name. The local independent merchants who sell Clippercraft clothes are substantial established businessmen, anxious to win and keep your friendship by giving you honest values. Now, they really mean it when they say, compare Clippercraft clothes with clothes costing many dollars more. That's why men who know insist on Clippercraft clothes bearing the Clippercraft label. So be sure to visit the Clippercraft store in your city.
These leading stores in the metropolitan area are proud to add their names to Clippercraft in your suits and topcoats. In Manhattan, Saks 34th, Broadway at 34th. John Wanamaker Men's Stores, Broadway at 8th and 67 Liberty Street. In Brooklyn, Abraham and Strauss.
In Newark, New Jersey, Boulevard Men's Shop, Kresge, Newark. And in Jamaica, the B&B Clothes Shop, 16408 Jamaica Avenue.
Dr. Watson, we left you and Mr. Holmes at a very crucial point. He was about to become someone's guest in a coffin.
So he was, Mr. Harris. Holmes and I stood there on Baker Street by the gaslight in front of the funeral coach. The coffin was a horrible silhouette on the coach. Perched in the driver's seat was Jenkins, the mortician, and his helper. The plan to kill Holmes was to go into operation at midnight, and the clock had just struck 12. Well, Jenkins, the clock has struck. Holmes is alive.
True, Watson, but the plan is in operation, however. Eh, Jenkins?
It certainly is.
Holmes, how can you stand there without seizing this jackanapes?
I'll care to that, Dr. Watson.
Well, Inspector Lestrade. Well, you had him standing by, eh, Holmes?
Of course, Watson, if you'd learned the virtue of patience, I...
Step down off that driver's seat, Jenkins. Your helper, too.
Oh, no, you don't, Inspector. Get up.
I've a gun! Stop or shoot those horses! You'll be killed when that coach turns over.
Hold up, hold up. Whoa! I think too much of my neck, Inspector. I didn't think you'd disregard regulations and carry a gun. But I'm not risking my life to see this through. I'll come down. I'd a lot rather spend a while at Dartmoor than split my head on the road.
Come on. Come on. You're under arrest for threatening homicide.
Oh, thank heaven, Holmes. Something's been done about this.
Has it?
Walk ahead of me, Jenkins. My men are at the corner. I'll turn you over to them.
All right. All right.
Seems to have worked successfully, Holmes. We've got the man.
Good night.
Good night, Lestrade.
Well, I shall be most interested to learn what was back of all this. Should come out of Jenkins' trial, don't you think? Well, shall we go upstairs, Holmes? Return to the flat?
No, Watson.
Well, why not?
Because we scotched the snake, not killed it.
Yes, but Jenkins and his man have been taken away.
And what remains before us, Watson?
What remains? Well, the coach, I suppose. And the coffin, the coffin, Holmes. Look at it. It's open.
It is opening, Watson. And in a moment, stepping out of that coffin, you shall see the gentleman responsible for this entire affair. The sole opponent who can mobilize the powers of darkness so well that he commands even my respect. One of the first brains of Europe.
Professor Moriarty. Good evening, Holmes. Dr. Watson.
Moriarty, I've been expecting the pleasure of another meeting with you ever since Jenkins first arrived at my flat.
Really, Holmes? Then you recognize my hand in this? You tell me about it. Oh, don't be disconcerted by my revolver.
Moriarty, only a brain such as yours would presume to obliterate the police of London. Stage of mass murder.
A magnificent idea, I think. The picture was irresistible to me, Holmes. Imagine the canvas, if you will. Once I have killed a sufficient number of police, you will have a London without law and order. A great city, demoralized, chaotic, stripped of its civilized airs. The people of London reduced to their animal level. Yes, just as Gustave Doré did in his etchings of Dante's Inferno. I shall be an artist who creates a panorama of degradation. I'm well on my way, Holmes.
Yes, Moriarty. Of course, Jenkins can no longer do the murdering for you. He's been captured.
Oh, I've so many on my staff. Besides, Jenkins will be released.
He certainly will not.
I shall release him, Dr. Watson. I promised him that. Removing a man from Dartmoor should not be difficult for me.
You promised him that? Then you anticipated Lestrade's arresting him.
Certainly. I knew Holmes would have police skulking about somewhere. I knew I must distract them. So I sacrificed Jenkins, leaving me alone with you and Holmes. You see, Holmes, if I am to banish law from London, you must die too. I shall therefore kill you now and place you, as I swore I would, in this coffin.
It would be a supreme delight for you, Moriarty, wouldn't it? To have gone so far as to inform me in advance that I was to die. to have selected my coffin and succeeded in placing me in it.
That is just what will happen now, Holmes. I shall pull the trigger, which is just a foot from your celebrated brain, and I shall blow that brain of yours to bits.
Of all the...
I have placed just two bullets in here, Holmes. One for you, one for Dr. Watson. A conceit, I admit. Now, you will become my guest in that coffin. I pull the trigger.
My leg!
Did I get him, Holmes? I can't see.
Yes, Lestrade.
No, he didn't. My leg is bad, but... There it goes in the coach. Shoot again, Lestrade.
Found it, I was too far off. We never catch that funeral coach now. Holmes, why didn't we think of blocking off all the surrounding streets in case this happened?
Yes, you have Jenkins, Holmes, for the murder of the Bobbies. But now Moriarty will go on to devise some new deviltry and challenge you again. Why didn't you think of that, Holmes?
Didn't I, Watson?
Brand in soda, Holmes?
No, Watson, thank you.
No, by Jove, this affair happened so quickly, I don't quite understand how you defeated Moriarty.
The fact that it was Professor Moriarty who was behind this carnival of crime, Watson, was obvious. The nature of it, as I've pointed out, indicated just one man. It was also clear the attempt to kill me would involve Jenkins, who was the puppet manipulated by Moriarty. But I knew that Moriarty himself would attempt the actual homicide, trusting only himself with a major task of a murder.
I see.
Moriarty hoped we would concentrate our attack on Jenkins and his helper, the only assassins visible, and that we would relax our guard after their capture.
Yes, quite.
He believed that would leave the field clear for him. But he did not think one step further. He should have realized, I guess, he was behind this, that I'd know he was eventually a peer, either in disguise or in hiding. And what place more convenient and less likely to be examined than the coffin itself? I realized all this in advance.
Then you told Lestrade to arrest Jenkins, go through the motions of leaving, but to return almost instantly to deal with Moriarty, who would still be due to appear probably from the coffin, eh?
Precisely. And there was a rather neat balance to the tableau, I believe.
What do you mean?
Moriarty, vanishing into the night, on the funeral coach, whipping his horses, the coffin bobbing up and down behind him. Moriarty, with his first and only love, death. And I, with mine, my easy chair, and my pipe.
Well, Dr. Watson, the guest in the coffin was a spine-tingling adventure. I'm sure you have another tale for us next week that's just as intense and thrilling.
I most certainly have such a story for you, Mr. Harris. Next week I shall relate to you the adventure of a hangman and the book. It concerns a park in Paris, famous for its lovely trees and flowers, a dead body dangling by a rope, and a bookstore that concealed an awful secret.
The makers of Clippercraft Clothes and more than 1,200 stores from coast to coast have brought you another in the new series of broadcasts featuring the world's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes. Our stories are based upon the character Sherlock Holmes, created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The program is produced and directed by Basil Lochran. Sherlock Holmes is played by John Stanley, Dr. Watson by George Felton. This week's story was written by Howard Merrill with special music by Albert Berman. Be sure to listen next week to Sherlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Hangman and the Book. Cy Harris speaking for Clippercraft Clothes. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.